keeping an open mind, but keeping in touch with your intuition and not being too naive is a really good mix. And just, you can have incredible experiences and be incredible people and really grow as a result of it as well.
That was Laura Delfara, and this is the All Things Risk Podcast, Episode 3. Welcome, or welcome back, as the case may be. My name is Ben Cattaneo, and I'm the host of the All Things Risk Podcast. This is a show where I have long-form conversations with fascinating people that have revelatory, insightful, useful, but most especially non-conventional approaches to the concepts of risk, resilience, and uncertainty. This show's a labor of love. It's a side project for me, and it's largely an excuse to have interesting conversations with these people. I make no apologies for the fact that I am very much learning as I go. And if you've listened to the first few episodes, do subscribe, like, share, send me some feedback at allthingsrisk@gmail.com. If you haven't, please check out those episodes. Okay, folks, today I'd like to start out with a question. And that is, have you ever wanted to do something epic or great for yourself, really for yourself, but you never did or you haven't done it yet? Maybe something like travel somewhere new or make a major lifestyle or career change, make a major change for you or your family, or learn something entirely new. But maybe along the way you had some thoughts that you can't do that for reasons maybe X, Y, Z. And I wanted to talk about this because I think that risk aversion is all too common, particularly and increasingly in Western societies. We're told very often, directly, but also maybe even more often subliminally, to value security, to value comfort. And I think that that comes at the expense of challenging ourselves and having some really great experiences. And if we err too much on the side of comfort and security, I think that we end up increasing risk for ourselves for a couple of reasons. One is because I don't think that comfort equates to happiness and fulfillment. And even bigger than that, I think that it's also, if we do that on a sustained basis, it's a recipe for a whole lot of regret. So let's not do that. Let's choose to have some great experiences. And with that, I would like to introduce my guest today. Laura Delfara is an entrepreneur, a writer, a blogger. She's a traveler, an adventurer, and a Muay Thai practitioner. She's based in Toronto, Canada, and runs a site called Milk Blitz Street Bomb, which is pretty much a site where travel and martial arts meet. It's a guide, it's a blog, it's a number of wonderful things. And she was recently featured in the Toronto Star. She is an embodiment of the view that we don't have to do what we're supposed to be doing, what we think we're supposed to be doing. And for the purposes of this show, Laura's journey started in 2006, when she started to study the Thai art of Muay Thai, Thai kickboxing, if you're unfamiliar. And she decided that she'd like to go and study that at the source. So she spent 6 months training in Chiang Mai, Thailand, and really got enamored with the purity and the directness of the art, and also the humility that she found amongst many of the practitioners. And she also got a taste for a certain kind of life. She came back to Canada and decided to make a bold move. She sold a lot of things and she redesigned her life, effectively moving to Thailand to train full time, sort of in the Tyler Durden from Fight Club sort of way. The things you own end up owning you. She sold a number of things and spent first a year in Bangkok, and then ended up spending the remainder of her time in a place called Buriram, which is in northeast Thailand near the Thai border. So 3.5 years And when she embarked on that part of her journey, that's when the adventure really began, because that's when the romantic assumptions about travel kind of wore off, but the adventure really ramped up. And when we say adventure, it does imply a level of challenge and uncertainty. And when we have those kinds of experiences, then they can turn out to be very profound, very wonderful, and very life-changing. And so few people on this planet have those kinds of experiences. So I think, and when I started to see what Laura was doing with her site and with her life, I thought, we need to talk to her on this show. So we have a very wide-ranging conversation. I talk with her about how she first got into Muay Thai, and she first had the idea to train in Thailand the first 6 months, coming back, and then the decision that she then made to move there longer term. And the training that she undertook there, the challenges, and particularly what it was like being a solo female traveler in Thailand. And that led us to a conversation around her site and how she decided to build the site that she wishes she had when she started her adventures. We also spend a lot of time talking about culture, which I think is a really interesting part of the discussion. I think in the West, we often, and maybe not just in the West, all cultures really, but we often romanticize about other cultures, we make presumptions, we judge, and a lot of these things are based on ignorance. And what Laura did is she actually fully immersed herself into Thai culture and was able to unpick a number of the layers of a very, very complex culture. And picking up for one of her blog posts, we talk about her Western mind and her Eastern mind. And then we also talk about culture shock coming back to the West. It's a very authentic conversation. Laura's wonderful. She's very cool. It delves a bit into the existential. And I think you will thoroughly enjoy it. So ladies and gentlemen, I give you Laura Dalfara. Enjoy. Laura, thank you so much for joining me today. I started this site really, or this podcast to interview some really interesting people that have embraced uncertainty uncertainty and resilience in all walks of life. And I know you from high school. We went to the same high school together, and I came across your website it was about a year and a half ago. And then I listened to a podcast that you were on, and I thought, wow, Laura's done some really amazing things and really embodies a lot of the things that that I wanted to get across with this podcast. And you were right up there on my list of people that I wanted to talk to.
Thank you so much.
So, Laura, I guess one of the first questions is, you run this site called Milk Blitz Street Bomb, which is all about primarily Muay Thai, and it's about your time studying Muay Thai in Thailand. What do you tell people that you do when they ask what's your, and I know a lot of people that I interview are it's a question that they're going to hate because because it's a difficult one to answer, but how do you answer that question?
What do I do? I think right now it is a difficult answer, because I guess essentially at this point I'd like to see myself as an entrepreneur, right? But I'm managing so many different things at once. So for a while I was doing some freelance writing and editing, working at a concert venue, bartending sometimes. Sometimes I work for a concert promoter. I get kind of linked up with bands, and if they need someone to sell merch, like just really basic stuff, I can do it so I can work during the day. But that wasn't my background, right?
Yeah.
But at this point, I'm kind of like doing so many different things that I think for some people it almost sounds like a cop-out, but I'm not. I'm really doing a lot. And I guess I kind of stumble when people ask what I do.
Right. Yeah, that's all right. I believe that these are the most interesting kinds of people. I'm nearly going to be 43 years old, and I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. So that's absolutely fine. That's actually excellent. So that's a perfect answer, in fact.
Thanks. I was going to say, at this point, what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to make the website actually into a business. If I can make it a full-time thing, it'll be great.
Yeah.
If it's a side kind of hustle, that's cool too.
Sure, but, sure. Okay, cool. I want to get into your story first. So I want to understand a little bit. So you spent all this time in Thailand learning Muay Thai, and I wanted to understand how you came across, how you got involved in that, and where did your interest in Muay Thai start? When did that become a thing that you found in terms of a passion?
You know, I think from the time I was really young, I had an interest in martial arts. Mm-hmm. There was, it was a show in the 70s. Was it Kung Fu?
Yeah, David Kung Carradine? Fu. Yep. David Carradine, yeah.
And I remember just thinking that seemed like a really cool way to live. You know, mm-hmm. just kind of like, I liked the idea that he was just kind of nomadic and whatnot. I haven't seen the show for probably since I was a kid, but I remember it really struck me. And so I had an interest in martial arts, and I spent a great deal of time doing, I guess, the things I'm supposed to do, like school, and I started working like after university, right away and whatnot. And there just came a point in my life where I was like, I needed to do something more for me, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I thought, okay, it's time I do what I really wanted to do as a kid. And one of those things was martial arts. So the time I was living in Toronto, and I went to I was originally interested more in Japanese martial arts, I think. And
right, yeah.
I went to different, you know, dojos and gyms or whatnot. And nothing was really resonating with me. And then I walked into a Muay Thai gym. I had friends who were just kept telling me, just check Muay Thai, you know. Mm-hmm. And I went in and I just thought, yeah, this is it. Mm-hmm. You know, and what attracted me to it was I find it to be very direct, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, there isn't a lot of wasted motion in Muay Thai. Mm-hmm. And what I also had a difficult time with the other arts too was that I don't have a hard time following people, but I have to really respect the person that I have to know that my teacher's capable of being a leader, mm-hmm. you know, and not say abusing their power or whatever. And I found that the other martial arts were really big on that hierarchy, and I wasn't getting the right match.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So that's how I found myself in Muay Thai. And
I can see that. And there, I study a martial art where we do have that hierarchy, and the way though it's kind of explained is that it's a bit more for the student than the teacher, but it can be a problem because, you know, just because somebody wears a certain color belt doesn't make them any better than you or any more, you know, any more proficient or a better person, right? And it's so it's the art of the eight limbs, right? The Muay Thai that they tell you. So it is very direct, isn't it? So you trained, and how often were you training in Toronto? And
well, I think the first gym I went to doesn't exist anymore. It was a place called Tiger Muay Thai, and I think that might have been around 2002. I'm not quite sure. 2002, 2003. I think it was 2002. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to go in at least three times a week. The gym, they were only teaching people, I think, three times a week, maybe four times a week. They were sharing like a space above like an auto body garage with another martial art. Like I can't remember what the martial art was, but I was trying to go in as much as I could, but it was also pretty far for me.
It was,
you know, 45 minutes to an hour on transit each way after work, you know.
Right.
I was doing that, and I quit for a while. And then a friend of mine, or a girl that I had met at the time, really convinced me to go to another gym. And I did. And because it had just opened up, it was this place named Crudar, which still exists. Mm-hmm. And then I wasn't really feeling that either, you know, and there were just things that weren't resonating with me. And she had just come back from a trip to Thailand, and she said, I think what you're looking for is in Thailand. And then I started working towards that.
Okay. So the seed was planted, and you were, so how, I get, was this sort of a direct kind of thing, like when you said, well, I need to go to Thailand, and it, you made it happen over the course of a, I imagine probably not a couple of months, but how did you work out a bit of a strategy for how to get there, or what was it? How did you make that work?
I think for me, what, I always had like enough money in the bank to kind of, I knew something was coming eventually. Like I started working, I think I was around 14 when I started working at like a bookstore. Right.
Okay. Wow.
So all through high school and whatnot, I was saving quite a bit of money. And, I'm really, that's really important to me. You know, it's kind of like to save. And then when something important happens,
right,
you're ready, you just kind of do what you can do. So I kind of, I think I already had a bit of the savings, if I remember correctly. And I was working at an office at the time, and I was working for pretty decent people, well, really decent people, and asked for a leave of absence. And they were okay with that. And I was able to make it happen. And then, you know, I was saving as well. Once I realized that Thailand was of interest to me, I just, you know, cut back on my expenses and whatnot. But that's for the first trip, because the first trip I went over there was 6 months, and then
okay.
I came back.
Okay.
Yeah.
So six months, and you did you know where you were gonna, were you gonna train, or did you think that you would get to Bangkok and kind of look around, or what was it? Like when you were making that plan?
There was a gym. There's a gym here called Siam Number One. And at the time, they had like a sister gym in northern Thailand. And the friend of mine, her name was Ange, that had gone there before me, she had trained there. And I just, so the plan really was just to, you know, maybe spend a couple days in Bangkok, then fly north to like the Chiang Mai area. And this was at a time when, like, none of this stuff was really on the internet at all, right?
What year was this?
So it was like word of mouth. The first trip, I think, was, may have been January 2007.
Right, okay.
So, like, a lot has exploded over the past
few
years.
Yeah, I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah, but at that time, it was more just, you know, word of mouth.
Yeah, and trial and error and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what I headed out to do. So,
did when you first got there, did the scene kind of align with what you were expecting, or were you surprised? Okay,
yeah, it was better than I was expecting, actually. And the people there at the time, it was, there's gyms in Thailand that are very, that are pretty much Thai only, you know, that haven't really accommodated foreigners before. People can't speak English and whatnot. And then there's like full on foreigner type gyms, and there's a lot of different ones in between. And at this time, it was a gym that, definitely accommodated foreigners. One of the owners, that stayed at the gym as well was a foreigner. And so it was a very beautiful mix. It was a really nice introduction. And, the teachers at the gym were what I consider like really good people. So it really exceeded any expectation I could have had. And it was beautiful. I think coming from here, like, you know, in Toronto, and like if I can say even to, in, from the West in general, where you have to time manage and multitask all the time. Mm. It was so beautiful just to wake up and you only had to do one thing, and that was train, you know? And that in itself was huge. It was beautiful.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. So, and the training was great too at the time, you know? And I think in retrospect, there were other places that had harder training or, you know, whatnot. But it, for, at the time for me, for an introduction to Muay Thai in Thailand, it was perfect. Yeah. Mm.
And was this a little bit more of the same kind of training that you were doing, but just very focused, or was it a little bit different or better? You said it was better.
I guess, you know, it kind of goes back maybe to my whole concept of like, I like process and whatnot that's very direct and very functional, I guess. And what I find, like, for at least for me, like a lot of the training I've seen, definitely in Toronto, and then I could extend it to some other Muay Thai gyms that I'm aware of their training here in North America. There isn't a lot of focus on Muay Thai, you know. There's a lot of focus on conditioning.
Right.
There's a lot of focus on, you know, there's focus on conditioning, but you're not really learning a lot of techniques. So you can train for years, and you can be really dedicated, and you still can't kick right. Where in Thailand, it's not. There's some gyms now that are changing, but traditional Thai training, you're not doing burpees, you're not doing anything.
You go
for your morning run, you come back, and you just work technique. And by that, you know, it could just be on the bag. It's on the bag, it's on pads, it's whatever, but just really chisel down to get it right. And that's what I was looking for.
That's that sounds really awesome. And I think you're right. I imagine that where you people have got students in the West and they've got whatever 3 hours a week to train, maybe the instructor doesn't want to bore them or whatever, and you know, move them through, you know, to, you know, more techniques or more this or that, or make them, you know, beast them, make them sweat so that they think that they're progressing or whatever. But you're right. I mean, I think that's
easier too.
Sorry?
I think it's easier to teach that way. It's better business plan, right?
Yeah, right.
Muay Thai in Thailand also is a business, so people, you know, fight, and the jets, how the gyms make money, right?
Yeah, okay.
So it's, the training's way harder, I find, here. But I think a lot of people do Muay Thai here recreationally, so they're there to lose weight. They're there to get and whatnot. So it's different. It's completely
they're
different.
They're looking for something a little different than what you were looking for.
Yeah.
Okay.
So and the level of expertise too.
Sure. I can imagine. Yeah. Okay. So that was 6 months and, and then that sort of came to an end and you came back to Canada. And then what happened? How did you, at some point you came back, but what was going on after the 6 months were up?
I had just, I guess, had a taste of a certain kind of life that I hadn't had here. Right. And I think it's just the ability to focus on a couple things, you know,
that's right.
Like that was really big. And I also found that, you know, despite, like, I felt like I had done everything quote unquote right in terms of what I could do, or fairly right. Like I had, I worked for really great people. I, you know, had, you know, decent friends, good work environment. You know, I lived downtown. Like there was a lot of things that quote unquote were successful and I was just suffering inside, you know, and a lot of it was just the, I wasn't using my skills. I wasn't I wasn't using my brain. I wasn't using my creativity. I wasn't using anything. I think, the job I had, because I graduated from university, but I felt like a lot of the work I was finding here within like corporate environments or not, the last job I had had was an architecture firm, more of a design firm, so they were less corporate. But I probably could have done a grade 9 or 10, you know?
Yeah.
And I couldn't. I really, for me, I'm not cut out for that. I can't live that way. Yeah, I need to, I like the process of evolving. I like the process of learning. I like the process of challenge. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do it. So I decided to come back and, and sell just about everything I had or all of it, and make my way to live. I would go back there and start, I guess at the time it would have been like what I considered like a nomadic lifestyle and see where it would take me and definitely train and see where just the process of learning Muay Thai full time in Thailand would take me.
That's really cool. I mean, I think a lot of people suffer quietly in those kinds of circumstances and they don't act, and it kind of builds up and builds up over many years. And maybe they go to the grave and they don't act on some of the sentiments that you had there, because I think there's a load of BS in every kind of corporate job, and if you sort of stick to that line, then I think at some point, unless you dive in and really find that passion and really fully explore it.
Is that I was physically getting sick all the time. I was getting tested for autoimmune diseases. I had my allergies, like, and a lot of those things that are often, they can't really find the root of. It could be stress, it could just be certain
there's a major mind body connection, I think, with things like that. I mean, the body reacts in ways when things aren't right. I fully believe that. So I'm not surprised. So you went back, and that was for a longer period of time. You didn't really have a. Did you have an end date in mind, or
no.
Roughly? Okay,
no.
Cool.
Not at all.
So you went back. Did you go back to the same places that you were training at, or how was?
Briefly. Mm-hmm. Ironically, my friend Ange was back in Thailand training, and we had gone to a really big Muay Thai event in Jamaica, and we, I had, because when I was in Thailand the first time for about 6 months, I had taken Thai language courses, so I'd picked up like really rudimentary Thai. Mm-hmm. So at this Muay Thai event where we were there for a week, I had met some really top Thai fighters and able to speak with them, just very basic. And I had met one who was really well-known fighter for a long time. His name's Lem Songkram, from this very esteemed gym in Bangkok named Chuatana. And he had said, if you come back to Thailand, come to Chuatana, I'll take care of you, like, in a very, like, gracious, nice way.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so I flew back to Thailand, and I was originally planning to go back to the old Siam Number 1 and stay up there for a long time. But the gym wasn't operating at the same level that it had been when I got there, and Ange and I decided to kind of go back to Bangkok and just go to Chuatana and see it. And when I walked in that gym, I had never ever seen anything like it in terms of the level of training, the level of expertise. It was just, it was just a completely different level. And then I stayed there for a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I imagine your level just skyrocketed, from, that 1 year in that environment. I would have thought that,
Sure. It was difficult, though. I think it was a gym that when I walked in, they had said, like, a woman has never fought out of the gym, and they never
Okay.
will.
Okay.
I was also not allowed in the ring.
Okay. Were there
Like,
other women training there or? Okay. Were
so
there
it
other
was
foreigners
lovely.
training there? I take it there would have been a few.
No, I
No.
think
Okay. Wow.
wait, actually there was. I think
Okay.
there was a couple people. There was a guy from he was Mongolian, and there was a guy from England, I think. Sometimes people kind of come over for a few weeks at a time, some
Right.
people for a few months. But there were, I'm sorry, I forgot, but it was
It's okay. No, I.
there were a couple, and sometimes there were times where there weren't, and then there was times where there were more.
Right.
But it was I would say that was the gym that really got my conditioning up. I got really strong there, and yeah, well, compared to walking into the gym in terms of technique and whatnot, I had learned a lot, but not as much as I think I could have. It's some of the issues there, especially with if there's gender kind of issues or they're not used to training women. Like, I didn't learn much of anything about clinching, and that's a really
Okay,
important part. And there
right.
was a lot of things that was held back, but I got really strong there for sure.
Right. Clinching is like when a lot of the that's when you use a lot of the like the knees and things like that in Muay
Yeah,
Thai
and a
that you
lot.
wouldn't see in kickboxing or in regular boxing. I,
It's
was
the
it?
close contact
Yeah.
grappling
Yeah.
stand-up thing. And the thing is that one of the reasons that a lot of gyms kind of, it's seen as a little too close contact between the sexes. So some people are shy. There are a lot of gyms that really don't know or are uncomfortable teaching women
Right.
that way. And there's some that do, but I stayed there because I recognized that I could learn a lot, and I did. And a lot of the things I did learn in terms of technique were also from other fighters, not necessarily the trainers sometimes, and so it was pretty incredible.
You dove in deep, right? You right deep
Yeah.
end, let's just jump in. Very cool.
Because I guess that's it. Like, it's also a time management thing. I don't want to waste my time on something that's kind of part way,
Yeah.
like a half it. I want to
Yeah. So
mess
you were
with.
training how many hours a day? Like what would a typical day look like?
We would start our morning run. If I remember correctly, I think it was 6 or 7 in the morning, and then morning runs were 10 kilometers, and then you would come in and maybe train for about another hour or whatnot. Rest, and then at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, train for maybe another 3, 4 hours. It depends. Some gyms, I would say on average, it could be anywhere between 6 and 8 hours a day,
Right.
so maybe, yeah, it really, really would depend. Sometimes less, no, definitely no more than 8. Depending how long you wanted to stick around. And that was 6 days a week.
Wow.
I'm just trying to remember because some gyms were different. But yeah, I think
Okay.
a safe bet would say, like, on average, maybe 6 hours,
Right,
7 hours.
okay. So you were there for about a year, and what when did that come to an end, or what did you decide to do at the end of that year? Why did that finish?
I had a lot of issues with bullying at a certain point from some of the trainers,
Okay.
and it was one of the trainers had been really trying to, or a number of them actually, like, extort sex.
Oh wow.
Yeah, there was a lot of I've written a little bit about it on the site, but
Yeah.
not much. There was a lot of that, to the point I could go into it for a long time. So what had eventually happened was I kind of brought a, I had the idea that I'm not going to let, say, there's four guys that are pretty awful. The other, 20 or so might be okay with me. So
Right.
I didn't want to let them break me.
Right.
But eventually they did. And I just, it just, there's also a thing like a face, and a number of them were all lying, saying that they were all sleeping with me. So then other ones would try to sleep with me, and then if I, and I would say no, and then they would get angry, because why am I sleeping with all these other people? And none of it was true, and I lost a lot of respect from the people. People didn't to believe. It broke my heart, but I had to leave.
Yeah, I can, I can only, I can't, I can't really imagine what that was. I can only imagine what it's like, but not fully. Wow, that was.
And I think too, with, if I can say, within the Muay Thai community, I suspect it'd be for a lot of other martial arts too. People are often resistant to even being open to hearing that people that look up to may be doing that. So there's, I tried to write a little bit about it on another website that I was originally writing for, and man, you know, the anger that it created in people, because, you know, people don't want to believe that that kind of
that kind of thing
can happen, you know, but it, so.
Yeah, that is, I think that, I mean, I wanted to talk a little bit about the concept of culture. Maybe we can get onto that in a moment, but but yeah, I mean, that sounds like you did the right thing by moving on, however it hurt you.
So I really didn't have a choice. I stayed too long.
And you moved on to a place called Buriram. Is that how it's pronounced? Or close up?
Close to
Was that shortly after you you moved on from what was Chawatana? Is that
Chawatana?
So was that happened right away, or what were you? How did you decide
I had actually kept an apartment at I wasn't allowed to live in the gym. A lot of times, most gyms, the fighters live in the gym, but at the time, women weren't allowed to stay there. So I had an apartment that was really just outside the front door, you know. So I had maintained that apartment while I went to check out to see if I could find good training in Buriram. And at the time, Buriram, there really wasn't a lot written on it at all online, and I had to go through contacts to try to find me a trainer. And
was there something about the region that attracted you, or what was it that led you there?
One of the things, Buriram, it's changed in the past few years, I think, but it's generally was known to be one of the poorest regions of Thailand, and it's one of the reasons a lot of boxers come from Buriram. And there's the whole northeast region called Isan, and Buriram kept just bringing out these incredible fighters, but it had a lot to do with the socioeconomics, right? Like a lot of the men ended up fighting just because that's all they could really do to make that money. But what I found is Chawatana had a lot of fighters from Buriram, and I tended to like them. You know, a lot of the ones that were from there just seemed really nice, you know. So there was a little bit of that affinity too. I was like, okay, like I seem to get along with a lot of the, you know, the fighters from Buriram. And also the way, you know, it works over there too, is that reputation is huge, and having people look out for you is huge. And there was an individual who had a very esteemed family in Buriram that was helping me. So it kind of all lined up beautifully.
Right. Okay. So you made your way over there and found a good place to train.
It was interesting because, there was a gym that, was really big and had supplied like Bangkok with a lot of, basically if you're fighting in Bangkok, you're at the top of your game.
Right.
Right. So there was this one gym that supplied a lot of supplied Bangkok with a lot of its fighters, and it was called Paratthanakit. Mm-hmm. And it hadn't been in use for a couple of years, but there was one fighter that never left, and he was still living at this kind of abandoned gym with the owner's first wife, because they don't fully divorce. They kind of just he'd started a new family, so his first wife was still kind of living there and allowed to live in this semi-abandoned gym, really. And the family that had helped me, they didn't have Muay Thai ties at all. You know, they weren't associated with Muay Thai at all, but they had heard about this gym and they had known this one fighter that was still there. So they went to him and asked if he would train me. And I found out later he didn't want to, but because of the social hierarchy, he couldn't say no to his family, right?
Right, yeah.
And so he said, okay, even though he didn't want to. And I had private training for about a year through him. It was just me and him, and it was the best training of my life.
Wow. Yeah. I did want to talk about you mentioned the hierarchy and the concept of Thai, of culture. And I think you had a great post where you talk about the Western mind and the Eastern mind. That example that you gave of your instructor, of your teacher, was just a great example. But as you're now living in Thailand, you're really embedded. And your posts are just great, but I can just kind of see you peeling the layers of Thai culture, and you know there's one layer and then there's another layer, and I don't know if you can just say some things about Western mind and Eastern mind, and I think you had a quote, and I can't quite remember the full quote, but it was something around that you think you've got a Western mind and an Eastern mind. What does that mean? What do you mean by that?
I think what happened is what I learned is that how we self-identify and our own personalities are strongly based on how the people around us see us, right? And one of there was a huge split. Actually, there was a huge split in terms of when I came back, how I would even see any given situation. I felt like I had sometimes two very competing worldviews at the same time in my head, and the voice I'm using now, I could never use this voice in Thailand.
Sure.
There were very basic things that fundamentally had changed about me that I wasn't even necessarily fully aware, just through the process of socialization.
I mean, the concept of face is pretty big, as you mentioned. Concept of hierarchy is pretty big. I mean, these are things that are also, Thailand is Thai culture, I imagine, has got a lot in common with a lot of the cultures in the region. But the concept of hierarchy, though, is really difficult for Westerners to wrap their brains around, because that example there. I mean, just makes social interactions so complicated. I can just imagine. I mean, that's a really interesting example. You had quite a few good stories, interesting stories about about the culture, the kind of culture clash. And people think that culture shock is this thing that you experience when you first land in a new culture, to me, I mean, I've lived in Korea and the Philippines for an extended period of time, but to me that's not what culture shock is. Culture shock happens like well into at least 6 months of living somewhere, where you the newness is gone, and now you've got to like make your way and kind of live, and you're like, holy shit. I don't get it. And that's to me is when culture shock happens. But it seems like you really navigated that well, throughout your time there? I mean, I guess you put yourself in a sink or swim situation in many respects, but it's
I was going to say, because some of the people I was relying heavily on and dealing with had never really had spoken to even foreigners before, much less like a female, right?
So how do they take that? You're in, like, Buriram is like this small kind of place. Well, it's small. It's rural, right? It's rustic.
It's a region it's a province, and it's also a city. Mm-hmm. So I was in the city. Mm-hmm. I think it's supposed to be a city of 30,000, but it didn't feel like that. It felt like about 10,000, you know? So I don't know how they do their census, like if that's just their mailing addresses and then people, you know, are in working. So it's very rural for sure. Mm-hmm. Even particularly when I was there, the city's built up a lot in the past 5 years or so. But it's rural culture, and it's a rural city. But I was going to say, like, in terms of culture shock, I found a lot of it coming back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Was just odd. Like, there were things that I realized I wasn't used. I guess one of the differences, I'm pretty convinced that I was using parts of my brain in Thailand that, like, literally, like physically using parts of my brain, and had to develop aspects of myself, perhaps, or thinking patterns that we don't use here.
Right.
And when I came back, certain patterns of thought that I didn't really have to use in Thailand kind of became lax, and I had to redevelop when I came here.
Could you give an example of that? One of those thinking patterns that you had to use there, you developed in Thailand, and then the other side, the kind of, you know, the dormant Western thinking that all of a sudden you had to use, but maybe struggled to remember.
I think over there, a lot of times I use the analogy of when you see people driving, right? So we have very strict kind of ideas of how to drive here in the West, you know, between law and whatnot. So everyone kind of follows the same pattern of driving, right? Mm-hmm. We're there, if you see, just even look at like, a short clip of people driving in Bangkok, it's very fluid. Mm-hmm. So you're very you have to be connected to everyone around you. And it almost becomes like this intuitive interplay of everybody. Mm-hmm. And if you block that out at any given time, there can be consequences for it. And it's far more, I guess, holistic. Mm-hmm. I guess, I don't know if that's the right term, but I felt that I had to be more on point, more intuitive, more constantly kind of reading other people, especially in the West, that we're far, I'll say here as opposed to Thailand, we're far more open with our thoughts, even in our facial features, expressions, so Thais are taught to smile through everything. Mm-hmm. So to kind of, if you really want to pick up on someone's genuine either intent or whatnot, you kind of have to catch it in their eyes really quickly, and so that's a whole different level of interplay, I find, as opposed to here. And we also have a lot more choices here. For example, when I came back, I remember one of the first things I originally went to, I have a brother outside LA, so I stayed there for a few weeks, and I was just a weirdo. Like, I just couldn't integrate. I didn't know what was going on. Mm-hmm. And then I went back. I came back to Canada, and I visited family. And my sister took me for coffee. And we're at a Tim Hortons. And, you know, the person's like, how do you want your coffee? And I thought, I have a choice? Like, what my choices were. Like, I just sat there dumbfounded. And, you know, because if I got coffee, it's like, you say, it's maybe I'll say not sweet. And that's the choice, that's right? Yeah, like, either coffee or not sweet, And so those sort of things, or I had a hard time really picking up the English language sometimes because I find Canadians speak really quickly. And
oh yeah, that's
people. I just would look at them and they're speaking to me like I should understand them. Yeah. And I couldn't understand what they were saying. Yeah,
what is this gibberish you're spouting?
That sounded like one long word. What?
Yeah, yeah.
So there was stuff like that. And I think in terms also power, right?
Right.
And I had lost quite a bit of power in ways that I had not fully recognized.
What do you mean by that?
It would be like one of the things too, and this isn't necessarily a reflection of all of Thailand, but I was socialized by some of Thailand's poorest people who have the least power, right? And so they were socializing me graciously, and I find that's a very beautiful thing there. I find Thais are very open to helping people integrate and into the culture, but they would socialize me how they were socialized.
Right.
So if I had gone in, for example, as a teacher at a university, I would have been socialized completely differently. There was that aspect, and then there was the aspect of being female. And so sometimes I kind of would align it like, imagine waking up tomorrow and everyone speaks to you like you're kind of an idiot. And it's just like that. And it's like, okay, what's going on, you know? And that kind of stays with you for a while.
Right. Yeah, I can imagine.
So when I came back, even the tone of voice, like I wasn't used to like tone of voice and body movements and like all these subtle things. I wasn't used to that kind of expression, and also I think the range of femininity here is more broad, so women express things differently. And I part of the socialization process was really cutting off a certain aspect that women are allowed here to have,
right?
A certain range, rather.
I think there's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot there that we could delve into. But I mean, where women are in society is in a place like Thailand. I can only imagine is vastly, vastly different from what we're used to in the West. So
complex too.
Right. And that whole concept of comes back to that concept of hierarchy. Yeah, I can understand. Is Thailand like? It's the Thai language. Does it have different ways of speaking depending on the status of who's speaking and to whom you're speaking? Is it like that or?
A little bit, but I think a lot of it's more social custom. And for example, like I'm assuming this would be the same in like other places. Like people who have, say, if you're kind of, I don't like using the term, but this is actually kind of a translation too, like lower, right?
Right.
You can't question someone who's hot. So there's a lot of accommodating. There's a lot of like, even in the language and the nonverbal language, there's a little bit of it, but I don't.
The nonverbal thing I think is pretty important throughout Asia. That the way in which people look at you and respond, and people speak with their eyes, and this sort of thing, because you can't say no if somebody asks you something. In most environments. And when I was living in the Philippines, one of the things that you really couldn't do is if there was somebody that was working for you or the organization, you couldn't criticize them in front of other people, for example. And that would be suicide. Not suicide, but I mean that would be you'd really be sticking the knife into whoever that person was. It's not good. And I mean. Yeah, I imagine. I can only imagine that the level of sensitivity that you had to pick up on to navigate your way through life in Thailand. I'm sure was pretty profound.
Yeah, And I think one thing too, if I can add, one of the things like for me that is hugely like to not overlook is that there's, I don't want to use such black and white terms, but there's good people and bad people everywhere, right? So
that's right. Yeah.
So there are going to be, and I've seen foreigners do this with Thai women, absolutely, mm-hmm. as well. There'll be people who'll try to exploit their position or someone's ignorance of how things work.
Yeah, right.
Like how the culture works,
right,
and whatnot.
Right.
And so some of the difficulty just came from, you know, being in situations, sand gyms, with people who were just really not nice people.
Mm. Right.
So then it's a
right.
whole other layer too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Not everyone has your best interest at heart, right?
Right.
So, yeah. So it was a mix, but I learned quite a bit,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think, I don't know if you found this too, but having to be in tune like that, you pick up, I find that I can read people much better now, mm-hmm. in terms of understanding situations that I think I was pretty naive to.
Probably. Right.
You know, so there was quite a, I kind of pick up on subtleties that I wouldn't have had and I lived in a culture where it was normal to pick up on those subtleties.
Yeah, definitely. I certainly found that during, as a result of my time in Asia. I mean, it's really interesting. Manila is like a little bit like what you described, because everybody's from somewhere else. And if you're from, you know, whatever, you know, province or part of the country where everybody knows you and there's sort of a clan kind of a thing going on, you can't really do anything kind of untoward without having a huge amount of shame. But in Manila, that goes out the window. So it does attract a certain, you know, a certain level, a certain element that isn't, doesn't have anyone's best interests at heart. I can, and living in the UK, like there are tons of these like reality television shows of like some old pensioner or something from the UK who got ripped off by his Thai wife or something. Every other month I seem to see something like that on television.
But you know what though? It's a standard hustle that it just, it happens quite a bit, because it's kind of, if you have the choice of working in this sex industry,
mm-hmm.
and you can make so much per day being like, say people go in and they hire a girlfriend for their
mm-hmm.
vacation time, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the real money,
right,
is when you can kind of get someone to build a house on your family's land and do that sort of thing. And, you know, it's that sort of practice, I would say, is often looked down upon,
mm-hmm.
depending on your social class and
mm-hmm.
whatnot. But it happens so much.
Sure.
It really, really does. And
Sure.
That was because the area, Buriram, is also an area where, so the men, a lot of the men go into fighting and a lot of the women go into sex work.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there, I guess there was a lot of discussions about that, like when I was there,
mm-hmm.
with either like expats living there or
mm-hmm.
also just local ties as well.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
it's, I would, yeah. But on the flip side too, there were, one of the things that I really enjoyed living there was that, because I think the language, like my accent or whatnot, was also like a lower class accent,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So say if I went someplace, even Bangkok, and say I decided to go to get a massage, and the
mm-hmm.
women in there couldn't speak English, but then
right.
they could speak to me. I would have some really hardcore conversations with women, because sometimes
right.
I think a lot of, they'd want to talk shop right away, because
right.
who knows if they could do this
yeah.
again. Right?
Yeah.
And one of the things I, especially when they would have these questions about Western men and whatnot, I really tried to put some, like, let them know about certain things that are not acceptable, mm-hmm. say, in I would say most countries in the West in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, how to treat women mm-hmm. or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so just to kind of let them know about some of the exploitation factors, because there's Western men that go over there and just say, oh, no, this is what we do in England. Yeah. And it's mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. when? Like 150 years ago? So, you know, that happens as well. So it can be, I don't know for you if you found that in the Philippines, but me just kind of being aware of a lot of this, it was a little surreal for me.
I mean, you definitely see the kind of 50, 60-year-old, you know, Western man, you know, overweight, whatever, with a 18-year-old Filipina, and it's, you know, just like, oh my God. Well, after a while, it becomes part of the scenery, unfortunately. But I imagine the same thing happens, right? That's how it works. But you do get some of those stories of the kind of reverse exploitation as well. But you know, it's partly socioeconomics, and you know, that in some cases. I don't know. I kind of hate to say it, but you think these people deserve each other in a sense. But that's a little cruel. But
there's objectification on both sides.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah.
So there's where a little bit of the root, I think, is.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's a transaction. Okay. When did you decide to come back to Canada? What led you to kind of finishing off your time in Thailand, and what was it that said, I think it's time to go back?
To be completely frank, it was my place as a foreign female there. Mm-hmm. I just realized at a certain point that my quality of life would be a lot lower than I was okay with. You know, and what I valued and whatnot. Like I couldn't, it wasn't for me.
Right.
And so I thought, okay, I'm going to check the Philippines. And I went to the Philippines to try there. 'Cause I thought, you know, maybe, getting out of Muay Thai at that point was a good idea for me too. 'Cause I think, I learned way too much about some of the darker side of Muay Thai over there, and I thought, okay, it's.
I mean, I can imagine there's a whole element of exploitation with fighters, and you know, there's.
It's human chicken fighting.
Yeah.
You know, for the most part, it really is, and sometimes you can get gyms where they'll treat the fighters like family, like kind of family type gyms, but a lot of gyms are not like that. It's it's human chicken fighting, like it's. In my opinion, you know, and
was there any element of in some of the teachers or some of the gyms, like of the kind of the more spiritual side of fighting, or like meditation or anything? No, it's just fighting.
Yeah. I think a lot of it, I know it exists, and there's some people I would think. To me, this is my own personal opinion, there's a big division between trainers that are somewhere in their 50s and ones that are younger. And I don't know if it's because the business of Muay Thai changed a bit too.
Right. Did you compete at all? Did you get in the ring and...
I did.
Yeah.
Not a lot, which is odd. Like my path in Muay Thai over there is not the typical kind of foreign path. And I just really, really wanted to get as good as I could.
Right.
So, you know, I wasn't caring about promotion or all of that. I just really wanted technique, and I really wanted to get to be good.
Right.
So I did fight, but not remotely as much as I could.
But what was that? I mean, just what was that experience like? Because I can imagine there's there's an element of fear. I certainly, if that was me, you know, that you kind of have to confront. What was it like when you're in the ring?
I think for me, I dealt with I dealt with it ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So The way that I kind of personally found to deal with it is that, say, if I knew a fight was happening, sometimes they give people a few days' notice, but, you know, say I had like a couple weeks or whatever. I really saw it as preparing for death, you
right,
know?
Right.
And what I did is I made peace with everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of sat there and really thought about everything, made peace with everything. Mm. So when the day came to fight, I was nervous, but I wasn't like, it was a certain, it's almost like the adrenaline's in you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it wasn't this like, oh my God, what's going to happen? It's like, okay, it's time.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found for me for fighting was, it's weird. First fight I had, I was actually bored, and that was surprising to me, you know. And then the second one, I was seeing it as it's funny because I saw it more almost like as a group thing where it isn't. Yeah. It's not like you and I are in this together.
Like
I'm supposed to be trying to knock you out. Right? But it was the beauty of it, I think there were two things for me. One is just like you're truly living in the moment at that time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
you can't think about what you're gonna have for dinner.
It's not like you can't really do much. And
that's what I think is awesome about a lot of you know, martial arts, or just in fact any in many cases any athletic pursuit. But really acute in, you know, the circumstances that you just described. I can imagine it. Yeah, I can see how it made you feel completely alive as well.
And to be really, really honest, the one thing I liked about it was I didn't have to be nice. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right. I'm not taking it anymore.
I don't have to turn the other cheek and be a good person. I can just hit them back.
Yeah.
You know, there's no reason to kind of rise above, like, intellectually or ethically.
It's just
try to be the better person. It's shot for shot.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was freeing for me, especially living, like, I was in a culture where I felt like I had to kind of absorb a lot of things.
Yeah.
Wow, no, I just get to.
Oh, very cool. Yeah.
You know? So that, like, even that was okay too.
Yeah, excellent. So just along the way, you set up this site, Milk Blitz Street Bomb. I wanted to talk a little bit about that. So why you set it up, and what your vision for it was at the time, and that kind of a thing. So you set it up while you were in Thailand, right?
I did, yeah. Originally, I had, I guess it would have been my second trip. So I think I flew into Bangkok, I think that was January 2009.
Mm-hmm.
I had started writing. I had been asked to write for this site out of England called My Muay Thai.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started writing, you know, about my experiences and training and whatnot. And then the longer I was there, I think, you know, by the 6 month mark, like training in Bangkok, I started really, there was a lot of dark stuff that was kind of coming out. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And I just want to put this here, like the owner of the gym at Chihuahua was always incredible, but when he wasn't around, there were things that were happening.
Yeah.
And so my writing started to adapt to the reality of my time there, as opposed to the fantasy that a lot of people kind of had at the time. Because at the time, there weren't a lot of people writing about it. And as far as I knew, I think for the audience that that site had, I could have been like the only female at the, that had been writing about, like, that I was aware of, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So what had happened was I was talking about, you know, say trainers trying to extort sex, or I was at a gym in Japan. I got a promoter brought me into Japan, and that was kind of a really, it wasn't a good experience in terms of like agreeing to one thing and then showing up and something completely different going on. And treatment there, even as a girl, like, it was confusing.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And I found that the audience at my Muay Thai, a lot of them weren't open to hearing it, right? So I kind of went, okay, where I want to take this direction, where I what I consider the reality of part of the process, also, you know, at the time, it was specifically to Muay Thai, I need a different audience. Mm-hmm. And I was also learning a lot about just navigating Thai culture that you wouldn't find, and they're not going to write about certain things. Yeah. You know, you looked at like a Lonely Planet travel
guide. There's no manual about how to deal with Muay Thai instructors trying to extort sex.
Or even just being a woman in the culture. Yeah, there's you know, maybe a page on it, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so I wanted to write about that stuff. So a lot of my training and my way of navigating, even say if I wanted to be, you know, fight a lot or whatever, that was really compromised by trying to like understand the culture where there was no primer. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to write about it. So I created my site more as a, it was a personal blog at the time. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get just certain things out, and I wanted to help people through my experiences and teach them what I wish I knew. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, just kind of have like a bit of an outlet, like for writing and whatnot. And then it developed to now I have a number of contributors on the site, and
right.
I'm turning it more away from a personal blog to like a larger platform
right.
for different voices, including my own, but for different things. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's a great site. Where does the name come from? How did that come about?
That actually came about in Japan. And what I really liked about what I saw there was how I don't know if they do the same in Korea, but definitely in Japan, that there's like that sense of taking a bunch of English words and kind of putting them together,
right.
So it
yeah.
makes sense,
yeah.
but it
mm-hmm.
doesn't, but it makes mm-hmm. you think. And so I was just I was in Japan, and I was setting up a profile for another site, and I thought about, I had to have like a, you know, a username or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought like, okay, what can I do? Right. And mm-hmm. then I'm like, okay, I wanted something pure, and I'm like, okay, milk, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And there was a band I was listening to at the time, like an English band, like Blitz. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted something impactful. So I'm like, hey, I don't know, Street Bomb.
Mm-hmm.
So when it came time to create the site, I just thought, okay, personal blog, what would be interesting? Because I was thinking, you know, I wasn't thinking of it in terms of what would be easy to plug into Google and find.
Yeah, yeah.
I just thought, okay, what would be something kind of personal? And I thought, hey, what about that user? Because I felt like it mixed Western and Eastern together too.
Yeah.
And That's essentially where it
right.
came from,
and it started to get a following how did the following kind of come about, like how did you find people how did the following kind of grow?
I think I had created I guess a bit of a following on my Muay Thai.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those readers would contact me through Facebook or maybe some people even just emailing me through the My Muay Thai site. I can't really remember. So I had developed a little bit of that, you know,
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. I think it just kind of grew from there. And then, there's like a Muay Thai Facebook groups and whatnot. And then slowly, as I was learning more about how to optimize articles for search engines, that helped too to get
sure.
people.
Right.
I have a post like racism in Thailand, mm-hmm. And my experiences with it that people were just finding and writing me quite a bit, or women who, we're looking for like, you know, Western women experiences of Thailand or something.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
so that's where a lot of it grew from. And I think a lot of the audience though was the Muay Thai audience. And I think cause I had just been, I'm assuming I'd been writing for quite some time,
mm-hmm.
you know? Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's funny though, because there's a number of people writing about it as well, but I think part of what created a bit of a split, and I was talking about it before, I suspect, I don't know if it'd be the same in the Hapkido, or I suspect it's the same for a lot of martial arts. Sometimes people have a very narrow view of how they want it to be. And so a lot of my writing, I think, pissed people off.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And I think so. Sometimes there was like huge discussions online, like about it, or, you know, people who maybe didn't want to support the site, or, you know, so there was a bit mixed, but at the same time, that division, I think, also created really loyal followers too.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
It created a little bit of drama. Sometimes never a bad thing. But
right.
What did the critics just want something more on what technique, or something, or didn't want you to be as critical as you were, or that kind of thing?
I think there was a lot of questioning of what I was even saying was true, or in terms of basically anything I've written on the site because I dealt with some really serious topics and sensitive topics. I thought, if my close Thai friends had this translated, would I be comfortable with them reading it? And all of it, yes. But the thing, I think, the difference in the culture is sometimes I find, like, Thai culture as I know it can be very, like, say when I was using the term, like, people would use the term higher and lower. Right? We don't really use that in English, right?
No, without, we don't.
Yeah, it's considered kind of offensive. So there's things that I can't think of specifics, but I know there's ways of me describing things or saying things that happen that actually, to certain people's ears, sound offensive, but I'm like, because you're seeing it through your Western lens. But if you're in rural Thailand, this really isn't offensive. This is just kind of
it's the way it is. Yeah.
So there's that, but I really want to point out too, there's people who, I think there's some people who are very much into different types of profiting online from the Muay Thai. It could just be to fulfill their own ideas of having a following. It could be for money or whatever. And if my writing is going to make people question or have some.
Okay. Yeah.
It doesn't work for their business plan.
Yeah, or I can see. I can see that.
Their personal plan, if it's not a business plan.
Yeah, I can see that.
There was some definite flash, like, reaction trying to tell me to just.
Yeah, a lot of debates around, like, a whole ton of things come down to that. Like, you know, whether it's, like, the eating meat or I don't know, whatever, like, people putting out stuff that that hurts some interest, you know, there's a backlash, so it's really hard to sort through that. So, but what I think that means though is that you created something that had a genuine impact, or is having a genuine impact, which is great. If people weren't saying anything, then it just means no one's listening.
I think so. Yeah, thank you. That's a good point. What I've been happy about though too is like a lot of the thanks that I get were, say, someone else's struggles were similar to mine.
I can see a lot of people going to you and you know, asking for advice about how to, you know, how to go about training in Thailand. Just in terms of the key pieces of advice that you would give somebody that may be, you know, looking to do something very similar to what you did, or indeed yourself 7-8 years ago when you were embarking on all of this, what are maybe a couple things that you would counsel or advise? What would those be, do you think?
I think right now we're at a really great time where there's so much information online, and you can reach people. I mean, say even just for travel, when people want to do solo travel trips or anything like that, there's Facebook groups of, you know, hundreds, if not, you know, like 1,000 people who may be there to give you advice. My thing would be to And, you know, and it's, you brought this up too. There is a difference. I think there's a difference between if I wanted to go someplace for 6 weeks as opposed to a year and a half. It's a very different type of experience. But whatever people choose to do, particularly if you're going to invest quite a bit of time, I would touch base with people, like, particularly expats, you know, if you can. Mm-hmm. And, see if you can pick their brain a bit, or really, really research blog posts and individual, like personal accounts, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that's very important because it may give you a little broader idea of what to expect or how to respect the culture and whatnot. I would say, also just be, trust your intuition. It's mm-hmm. really important. And I think that's something that in the West, we don't place enough value on.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a difference between intuition and, you know, coming from a place of fear, right?
Yeah, like yeah.
Really.
Was that book, The Gift of Fear?
Oh, I haven't read it.
And that talks about those kinds of things. I mean, I think there is, our kind of fear radar gets turned on, or fight or flight response gets turned on and off, like, very regularly, particularly in our culture. Marketers know how to use it very effectively, but there is something there to it. And I think there's something about, you know, trying to train yourself so that you know when, you know, somebody's selling you some product that is going to transform your life or take away this thing that you don't like. There's a difference between that and actually genuinely trusting your intuition in a variety of circumstances. I guess much like you did when you left Chawatana.
Mm-hmm. And it can be, I think, what I've found is, like, at the same time, keeping a very open mind, but keeping in touch with your intuition and not being too naive is a really good
mm-hmm.
mix.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you can have incredible experiences mm-hmm. and meet incredible people and really grow as a result of it as well.
That's awesome. Yeah, that sounds like a pretty good place to wrap things up, actually. but before we do, I thought it'd be good if you could let people know where they can find you online.
Sure.
So it's Milk Blitz Street Bomb. Well, why don't you go ahead and let people know where they can find you?
I've bought a URL to shorten it. So
okay.
Even MBSB, so that would be Milk Blitz Street Bomb. So MBSB.us, and you can find me there.
Okay, awesome. Are you on Twitter or Instagram or anywhere else on social media?
Yep, and it'd probably be easiest to find me through the site. I have links to all those profiles there.
Okay, brilliant. Okay. Yeah. Okay, Laura, really appreciate you coming on and you know, sharing your story. I think it's awesome. I think what you're doing is awesome. And hopefully,
thanks for having me.
No, pleasure. And hopefully, if things go well on my end, that we'll have you back in a few months' time. I think that would be really cool.
That would be great. I'd really enjoy that, actually. So thanks a lot. This has been really nice.
No, likewise. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
Well, I thought that was just an awesome conversation. We covered a lot. And if you were thinking at any one point that you wish that we had stopped somewhere and explored any one of the topics in more detail, all I can say is that I fully agree. As I was doing the edits for the show, I certainly thought to myself, wow, we could have spent a lot more time here or there. It was a good problem to have. And you know what? There's a solution to that problem, and that is to have Laura back. And I really love that kind of the way we ended the show with that quote, that kind of yin and yang combination of intuition and doing your research and your homework to have some great experiences. I think it's a theme that has certainly run through the first three episodes of the show, in that having these great experiences, taking on uncertainty, is not about recklessness. It is about being prepared, in as much as it is also about your listening to yourself and your intuition. If you're interested in Laura, do check out her site. It's great. Milkblitzstreetbomb, mbsb.us. And if you like this episode, please share it. Spread the word. This is a growing podcast, and the only way that it can grow is if you share it. If you are interested in the more episodes, I mean, we have some great conversations lined up, some great guests. Please subscribe on iTunes, SoundCloud, or however you get your audio content. Do send me any feedback, whether that's feedback on the show, on anything about the show, or if you've got some suggestions about some great guests to come on, send me a note, allthingsrisk@gmail.com. And thank you so much to those who have already done this. I was absolutely flattered by some of the comments and also the great feedback that I got, and the wonderful suggestions, which I'll be incorporating into the show. Follow the show on Twitter. @RiskThings is the Twitter handle, and you can get updates on new episodes or whatever. Check out allthingsrisk.com, which is the show's site. All kinds of information there about how to subscribe. Lots of other resources on that site as well. Thank you so much for listening once again. We will speak to you soon. And in the meantime, don't forget, risk is life.